Nation bringing you Tag for Swag.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, Katie Weaver and Mario Ritter Jr. tell us about the agreement UN negotiators reached following the International Climate Meeting. Later, John Russell presents this week's Health and Lifestyle Report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, here are Katie and Mario.
Countries closed the United Nations COP27 climate meeting on Sunday with a deal to establish a fund to help poor countries suffering weather disasters. The agreement said that poor countries with limited money are most affected by extreme weather events like floods, heat waves, and storms. It established a committee to set up a fund to help deal with bad weather events. The Associated Press described the deal as marking a diplomatic victory for small islands and other nations affected by extreme weather. They won over attendees, including the United States and the European Union, which had resisted the idea of loss and damage. They feared that such a fund could open them to legal responsibility for historic release of carbon gases from industry and agriculture. Carbon gases are blamed for warming the Earth's atmosphere. Government leaders, environmentalists, and activists celebrated plans for a fund. But there are remaining questions, including how it will work and who will have long-term responsibility. Here is a look at the development of the idea of paying for loss and damage from weather events, and what is known about the fund.
The Alliance of Small Island States is a group of coastal and small island countries. In the early 1990s, the group began calling for the establishment of a loss and damage fund. The call came as the United Nations was creating a structure to limit carbon gases at an international level. Since then, the idea has been a part of yearly UN climate meetings. Developing nations and climate activists have pushed for the fund, but wealthy nations did not support the idea. At this year's climate meeting, the idea of loss and damage was included in the program and became part of discussions. The climate representative for the Marshall Islands said she was worn out but happy with the fund's approval. "So many people all this week told us we wouldn't get it," Kathy Jetneel Kitchener said. "So glad they were wrong."
The fund will first seek donations from developed countries and other sources, such as international financial organizations. Other nations could also join with their own offerings. The agreement calls for identifying and expanding sources of funding. That is something the U.S., the EU, and other nations had pushed for during negotiations. The term suggested that other nations that are both producing a lot of carbon gases and considered developing should also pay into the fund. During the talks, Chinese officials said money for the new fund should come from developed countries, not China. But in 2014, China voluntarily paid $3.1 billion to the Green Climate Fund, after a promise of $3 billion from the U.S. China is the world's biggest producer of carbon gases. In a statement, U.S. Climate Representative John Kerry said he would continue to press countries like China to significantly enhance their ambition in keeping the 1.5 degrees Celsius goal alive. The UN has set a goal of limiting the increase of the average temperature of the Earth's atmosphere to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Details about which countries will pay into the fund will be decided by a committee established in the agreement. The committee is to have 24 members. These are to include 3 from Africa, 2 from small island developing states, and 2 from the least developed countries in the world.
The deal says the fund will assist developing countries that are particularly vulnerable to the adverse effects of climate change. But middle-income countries that are severely affected by weather disasters are also under consideration. Countries that could receive funding include Pakistan, which suffered widespread flooding, and Cuba, which was recently hit by Hurricane Ian. David Waskow is the World Resources Institute's International Climate Director. He said agencies that are out there doing humanitarian work, helping people rebuild, dealing with migration and refugee crises, dealing with food security, water security, will need to see how their work fits in with the fund. Those details will also be negotiated by the committee in the coming year. Attendees said agreeing to discuss the fund is a big step forward, but observers say how quickly the fund is set up will decide how happy countries will be with it. In 2009, rich nations agreed to provide $100 billion a year to help developing countries move to energy systems that produce smaller amounts of carbon gases. However, that plan has never been fully supported financially. In the closing meeting Sunday, Antigua's Leah Nicholson said the committee should be set up immediately and given clear orders. This loss and damage fund must become the lifeboat that we need it to be, she said. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
A new study has found that the risk of death, hospitalization, and serious health issues from COVID-19 increases with reinfection regardless of vaccination. The study examined U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs data collected from March 1, 2020 through April 6, 2022. It included information on 443,588 patients with one SARS-CoV-2 infection, 40,947 with two or more infections, and 5.3 million who were not infected. Most of the study subjects were male. Reinfection with COVID-19 increases the risk of both acute outcomes and long COVID, said Dr. Ziad Al-Ali of Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. He added that this was clear in unvaccinated, vaccinated, and boosted people. Reinfected patients had a doubled risk of death and a tripled risk of hospitalization compared with individuals infected only once. The patients also had increased risks for a number of other health problems, the study, reported in Nature Medicine, found. The problems affected the lungs, heart, blood, kidneys, bones, and muscles. Reinfection also increased the risk of mental health, brain, and nerve disorders. Even if one had prior infection and was vaccinated, meaning they had double immunity from prior infection plus vaccines, they are still susceptible to adverse outcomes upon reinfection, said Al-Ali. He was the lead writer of the study. Susceptible means easily affected or harmed by something. People with repeat infections were 3 times more likely to develop lung problems, 3 times more likely to suffer heart conditions, and 60% more likely to have brain or nerve disorders, the study found. The risks were highest in the first month after reinfection, but were still clear 6 months later. The total risks of repeat infection increased with the number of infections, even after examining differences in COVID-19 variants such as Delta, Omicron, and BA5, the researchers said. We had started seeing a lot of patients coming to the clinic with an air of invincibility, Al-Ali told Reuters. They wondered, does getting a reinfection really matter? The answer is yes, it absolutely does. He added that ahead of a season that often involves travel and indoor gatherings, people should be aware that reinfection is serious and should take steps to avoid getting infected. Al-Ali explained that researchers are not suggesting serious measures, but maybe if you're going on a plane, wear a mask. Or, if a person is in a food store, consider that the person near you may have a weak immune system, and if you wear a mask, you might help to protect them, he said. I'm John Russell.
We just heard this week's Health and Lifestyle Report, presented by John Russell. Now, John joins me on the program to talk a bit more about the report. Hi, John. It's good to have you here.
Hi, Ashley. It's good to be here.
I'd like to talk about one word that Dr. Ziad Al-Ali used in the story. He said, reinfection with COVID-19 increases the risk of both acute outcomes and long COVID. Could you explain the word acute for us?
Well, acute actually has many meanings. Let's start with how it is used when talking about medical issues. In the case of Dr. El-Ali's usage, acute means short-term. Acute outcomes of a disease describe what happens to a patient soon after infection. Acute also means becoming very serious very quickly. So, an acute disease is one that becomes very serious very quickly. Finally, acute can mean very sharp or severe. For example, an acute pain is a very sharp or severe pain.
What does acute mean in other situations?
In other situations, acute can mean very strong and sensitive. For example, a person who has acute vision, sees very well. A person with acute hearing has sensitive hearing. They might hear things that other people have difficulty hearing.
Thanks for taking the time to explain acute for us, John.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to the Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. During the first half of the 19th century, leaders of the United States could find no answer to the question of slavery. The dispute grew more threatening after the war with Mexico in 1849. Northern states refused to permit slavery in the new territories of California and New Mexico. Southern states declared that they had a constitutional right to bring slaves into the new lands. The South was ready to secede, to leave and break up the Union of States. Then, in 1850, Senator Henry Clay of Kentucky offered a compromise to avoid secession and a likely war between the North and South. He said the Union was permanent and created for all future Americans. He attacked the South's claim that it had the right to leave. He warned the war that would follow Southern secession would be long and bloody. 1 week after Senator Clay spoke, Senator Jefferson Davis of Mississippi explained his position. He did not say much about Clay's proposed compromise. Davis was sure that no good would result from it, not even from stronger laws on the return of escaped slaves. Davis said what was needed was a change in the North's policy toward the South. He said the North must recognize the rights of Southerners, especially the right to take slave property into U.S. territories. Davis said Congress had no right to destroy or limit this right. He admitted that the old Missouri Compromise of 1820 had limited the right to take slaves into the territories. He said the 1820 Compromise worked not because Congress passed it, but because the states agreed to it. Senator Davis said the North was responsible for the growing split in the country because the North was trying to get complete control of the South. He said if these efforts were not stopped, the North someday would be powerful enough to change the Constitution and end slavery everywhere. Davis warned the South would never accept this change. 3 weeks later, the Senate heard another Southern leader, Senator John C. Calhoun of South Carolina. For years, Calhoun was the voice of the South. He now was 68 years old and a sick man. He spent the last week in February writing what he believed to be the true position of the South. Many senators understood it would be his last speech. On Monday, March 4th, the Senate was crowded when Calhoun entered. One by one, friends came to speak to him. The old man's long, gray hair fell to his shoulders. His face was thin and white, but his eyes were bright and his jaw firm. Calhoun was too weak to read his speech. He asked another senator to read it for him. Calhoun said that for a long time he had believed the dispute over slavery, if not settled, would end in disunion. Calhoun said it was clear now to everyone that the Union was breaking apart. that the ties that had held the North and South together were breaking one by one. Three churches, once united across the nation, now were split between the North and South. The major political parties, he declared, were divided in the same way. Calhoun said the North was responsible for all this disunity because it had destroyed the political balance between the two parts of the country. As the population of the North had grown large, he noted, that part of the country seized political and economic control. The North passed tariff bills the South opposed. It had filled most of the offices in the federal government. It closed the new territories to Southern slaveholders. And, said Calhoun, it viciously attacked the Southern institution of slavery. The situation was so bad, he said, that the South could not, with honor and safety, remain in the Union. How can the Union be saved, he asked. Not by the compromise proposed by the senator from Kentucky. There is but one way, a full and final settlement with justice of all the questions disputed by the two sections. The South asks for justice, simple justice, and less she ought not to take. She has no compromise to offer but the Constitution, and no concession or surrender to make. She has already surrendered so much that she has little left to surrender. At the end of Calhoun's speech to the Senate, Southern lawmakers crowded around the old man, congratulating him. But many of them could not agree with his demands and the violence of his words. By now, most Southerners believed that Senator Clay's proposals were a reasonable way to settle the difference and protect the Union. Yet Clay worried that Northerners might reject his proposals. Many in the North felt slavery was wrong. They opposed Clay's compromise because it might permit slavery in New Mexico, and because it called for stronger laws on the return of slaves who had escaped to the North. So Clay asked an important senator from the North to speak in support of his proposals. Daniel Webster represented the northeastern state of Massachusetts. Senator Webster believed that slavery was evil. Yet he believed that national unity was more important. He did not want the nation to divide. He did not want to see the end of the United States of America. Webster was 68 years old, as old as Calhoun. 3 days after Calhoun's speech, Webster spoke to the Senate. His voice was weaker now, but his words rang with the same strength as years earlier. I speak today, he said, to save the Union. I speak today out of a concerned and troubled heart. I speak for the return of a spirit of unity. I speak for the return of that general feeling of agreement which makes the blessings of this Union so special to us all. Senator Webster spoke of how he hated slavery. He spoke of his fight against the spread of slavery, but he disagreed with those who wanted laws making slavery illegal in new territories. It would not be wise to pass such laws, he said. They would only make the South angry. They would only push the South away from the Union. Then Webster spoke about the things the North and South had done to make each other angry. One, he said, was the failure of the North to return runaway slaves. He said the South had good reason to protest. It was a matter of law. The law was contained in Article 4 of the nation's constitution. Every member of every northern legislature, Webster said, has sworn to support the Constitution of the United States. And the Constitution says that states must return runaway slaves to their owners. This part of the Constitution has as much power as any other part. It must be obeyed. Next, Webster spoke about abolition societies. These were organizations that demanded an end to slavery everywhere in the country. I do not think that abolition societies are useful, Webster said. At the same time, I believe that thousands of their members are honest and good citizens who feel they must do something for liberty. However, their interference with the South has produced trouble. As an example, Webster spoke about the state of Virginia. Slavery was legal there. Webster noted that public opinion in Virginia had been turning against slavery until abolitionists angered the people. After that, he said, no one would talk openly against slavery. He said abolitionists were not ending slavery, but helping it continue. Then Webster said the North also had a right to protest about some things the South had done. He said the South was wrong to take slaves into new American territories. He said attempts to expand slavery violated earlier agreements to limit slavery to areas where it already existed. Webster said the North also had a right to protest statements by Southern leaders about working conditions in the North. Southerners often said that slaves in the South lived better lives than free workers in the North. Webster appealed to both sides to forgive each other. He urged them to come to an agreement. He said the South could never leave the Union without violence. Webster said the two sides were joined together socially, economically, culturally, and in many other ways. There was no way to divide them. No Congress, he said, could establish a border between the North and South that either side would accept. In general, Webster's speech to the Senate was moderate. He wanted to appeal to reason, not emotion. Yet it was difficult for him to be unemotional. His voice rose as he finished. Secession, he called out. Peaceable secession. Your eyes and mine will never see that happen. There can be no such thing as peaceable secession. We live under a great constitution. Is it to be melted away by secession, as the snows of a mountain are melted away under the sun? Let us not speak of the possibility of secession. Let us not debate an idea so full of horror. Let us not live with the thought of such darkness. Instead, let us come out into the light of day. Let us enjoy the fresh air of liberty and union. Northern abolitionists quickly criticized Daniel Webster's speech. They called him a traitor. But most people of the North accepted Webster's appeal for compromise. His speech cooled the debate that threatened a complete break between the North and South. Yet the speech was not the end of the debate.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.